Something has changed. We all sense it. Culture pressure is increasing, especially on our kids. But even in a world of addictions, ever-present screens, and gender identity questions, Christians can have clarity and confidence. John Stone Street and Brett Kunkel, A Practical Guide to Culture. Welcome to Hill Country Institute Live, a continuing conversation with Christian leaders who are addressing the key issues of our day with the love and mind of Jesus Christ. I'm Larry Linenschmidt, your host, and I want to thank you for being with us. We have a special guest and discussion on how we navigate the choppy waters of a post-Christian culture. 2 Corinthians 10:5 says we are to take every thought captive to Christ. What does that mean? How do we engage with people and live life fully in the heart and mind of Jesus Christ? Our featured guest, John Stone Street of the Colson Center, has been observing our culture and writing and speaking on this topic for many years. He's a leading cultural observer and teacher of worldview from a Christian perspective. We invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to hear past programs and to experience audio and video from our conferences on faith and culture issues, including art, vocation, racial conciliation, and more. You can also listen to this program and past programs on your podcast app at Hill Country Institute Live. Our previous guests include Andy Crouch, Oz Guinness, Jay Richards, and many other Christian leaders on faith and culture issues. We also ask for your consideration in supporting this program in the ministry of Hill Country Institute. You can donate online at hillcountryinstitute.org, or you can call us at 512-680-7993, 512-680-7993. We appreciate your help in paying the radio station to stay on the air. Now let's introduce our special guest. John Stone Street serves as president of the Colson Center. John's life work is to eliminate biblical worldview for today's culture. He's a speaker, writer, cultural commentator, and a collaborator on many worldview initiatives. He directs conferences, curriculum projects, speaks to groups nationally and internationally. He consults on worldview education for schools and churches, and he appears frequently on web and radio broadcast. John is the daily voice of Breakpoint, the nationally syndicated commentary on the culture founded by the late Chuck Colson. He's also the voice of The Point, a daily one-minute feature on worldview, apologetics, and cultural issues. He has co-authored 5 books, including A Practical Guide to Culture and Restoring All Things. He is also a theologian in residence at St. George's Anglican Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and he lives in Colorado Springs with his wife and 4 children. John Stone Street, welcome to Hill Country Institute Live.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Thank you. John, as I read and listen to your podcast and everything that you do, you just have such a passion for preparing the next generation of Christ followers to navigate the culture waters that we're in. So what really gave you that passion? How did that come about?
Yeah, not just really the next generation. I just think Christians are called not only with their gifts and talents and abilities that God has given them, but God calls us to a particular cultural moment. This is actually something that the Apostle Paul talks about when he's describing God to a group of pagans on Mars Hill. Luke describes it in Acts 17. And in the middle of that, Paul says something really fascinating, that God has determined the exact times that people live in the boundaries of their dwelling place. And so it's not an accident that we find ourselves in this cultural moment and not in another. And, you know, I was really inspired by the late Chuck Colson, who often would say, you know, what the world needs most right now is for the church to be the church. And that's really exciting to me. Personally, that just comes out of just my own growth of kind of growing up in an environment where the church was often positioned against culture. Culture was something to be, stay away from it or condemn it, not a lot else. And when I realized that Christianity wasn't something that took me out of the larger culture or took me away from the world, but actually was a framework for understanding it, that was like getting saved all over again for me. It helped me understand that faith was more than just about my eternal destination. It was more than just about my own you know, personal morality and obedience to God, but it actually was a complete framing of reality. It described the world as it actually was and invited me into a cosmic adventure, you know, that God was writing in human history, and that I could be part of that. That stuff was really formative for me. And so that's, you know, that's what I was really drawn to, and eventually in the work and life of Chuck Colson. And so, you know, that's kind of what we can try to continue to do today.
Yeah, sure. I relate to that. As a young Christian, I fell in with some folks who read Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis, and what great grounding that was. I've had a limited experience personally with Chuck Colson. Met him in Houston, and I was on a board of the Houston Baptist University at that time, not the board, but an advisory type board. And he came and spoke, and we had a nice discussion about applying worldview. And then I was at a conference with him in Oxford, and we were both in line to ask Anthony Flew questions. And for anyone who's not familiar, Anthony Flew was a long-term atheist who became a deist. There's no evidence that he ever became a full Christian, but he was there with Gary Habermas, who's done a lot of good work on the resurrection, and he and Gary had a good friendship. And, you know, it's a good model for what a Christian can do to embrace someone else. But anyway, it was my turn to ask a question, and it was getting late, and Chuck Colson was right behind me. So I said, well, Chuck, why don't come on up in front of me? And he said, no, you go right ahead. And I said, no, you please. So he got up there, and he got the last question. So it was a lot of fun. I think everyone preferred that Chuck Colson asked the question instead of me. I did. So anyway.
Well, that was a kind move of you.
Well, thank you. But I think it was appropriate, too. You know, I've been reading your book, A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. Which, by the way, I highly recommend, and we'll come in and out of that book as we're talking about conferences that Colson Center puts on, what they have going. But this book, it covers so many topics of interest, as well as outlining really how we should think and form culture ourselves and react as Christians to the ebb and flow of currents that we're facing. So Would you like to tell us a little bit about how that book came together? Because it seems to kind of culminate in all the ways that you're thinking about culture and you're getting families to interact together.
Yeah, it was really aimed at anybody who's calling involved mentoring or leading the next generation. So we've had a lot of parents and teachers, Christian educators, a surprising group has been grandparents who feel a generational divide, you know, that always exists really between younger and older generations of Christians, but it seems to be particularly pronounced today, mainly, you know, I think because of technology, sex, and Trump, those three issues are pretty divisive between the generations. But, you know, the thing is, you know, we want the next generation to love God. We want them to follow God. We want them to know who God is as God's revealed himself. And as a dad of four, that's what I want for my kids. And that would be hard enough if we weren't actually, if all we had to deal with was our own thinking, our own fallen thinking, and our, you know, our kids' independent thinking and so on. But we realize the cultural pressures add an entirely new set of obstacles, you know, to that. We obviously a hot topic in the news, at least around the Christian world, are ex-evangelicals or students who walk away from their faith, or you know, we have a complete rethinking of Christian moral claims by those who claim to be Christian and so on. So the culture adds a lot of pressure. So we don't get to choose the cultural moment. You know, as I said a minute ago, God chooses that. So God not only wanted my kids and my family, God wanted my kids in this cultural moment. And I don't particularly like that. I mean, that's actually one of the truths of the Christian worldview that I don't particularly like. I mean, I would much prefer that they had been born and raised in the good old days. I don't know when they were, but I've read about them. They sound great and sound a lot easier than today. But this is the reality. So we have to understand the culture. At the same time, culture is one of those words that's used a lot in Christian circles, but rarely defined well. Probably the most frequent use in many Christian circles is, you know, kind of the culture, and as basically a synonym for all the bad stuff in the world that we don't really like. And that's a really inaccurate view of culture. And it actually, it's such an inaccurate view that it negatively impacts our understanding of the Christian life, because then we want to limit the Christian life away from all of this bad stuff, as opposed to seeing Christianity as a restored humanness, an ability to be who God created us to be. And so we wanted to engage, Brett and I both. I mean, we wanted to engage this cultural moment for parents, grandparents, for educators, for teachers, for mentors, pastors, and youth pastors, because there are unique challenges. And, you know, in the introduction to his, you know, huge, massive work on systematic theology, which everyone has to read in seminary, Millard Erickson talks about why you need a new theology written for every generation. It's not because the truth changes, but it's because the cultural context always changes. And you have to then realize, okay, what are the application points here that need to be, you know, emphasized or rethought? What are the blind spots that we are now able to see because of the cultural shifts? And so, you know, that's really what we were trying to get at in A Practical Guide to Culture. And we also wanted to think about it well. We felt like there were books that took, you know, certain cultural issues and unlocked them. Those were really hard to keep up to speed, right? Yeah. Because it's almost like playing cultural whack-a-mole. This issue pops up and you got to smack it down, and this issue pops yes. up. And there's some of that in the book, but we talk about the difference there. Between cultural waves, those are the things that hit you and you know it, like a wave on a beach. But the difference between cultural waves and cultural undercurrents. Undercurrents are those dramatic shifts in the landscape, in the topography, in the, you know, under the surface that you don't even feel until one day you look up and you realize that you're not where you used to be. And that things have dramatically changed. So we wanted to look at culture in both of those senses, both the kind of the really loud, noisy aspects in issues of culture, but also these dramatic ways, particularly in the last 40, 50 years, that Western culture has shifted in such a way that it has left us dizzy and unprepared for the cultural moment. So that was a big reason we did what we did in that book. And tried to have a clear, both an accurate definition of what culture is and how culture, how the idea of culture fits with how God made us as human beings. But then also have a goal. I mean, a lot of times the goal of Christians engaging culture is either safety or anger or, you know, outrage or something like that. And we say, well, what would success look like if we were, if we actually pulled this off, if we successfully discipled a new generation to navigate these cultural waters, how would we know? What are those marks of success? And so we wanted to address that kind of, you know, like the title said, and theologically accurate, but also a very practical guide to dealing with culture today as a parent, grandparent, pastor, mentor, youth leader, grandparent is called to do.
Sure. Well, and it's really an extension of the work that you're doing at the Colson Center. And just in case there's anybody out there that's not familiar with the Colson Center, why don't you just outline what you're doing? I particularly love the team approach that you have of bringing people together. You emphasize your discussions in-house in certain ways. What's the Colson Center about?
We just exist to help equip Christians with the clarity, confidence, and courage they need to live in this cultural moment in a way that's faithful to Christ and faithful to the calling. That's just what we're not the church. We don't pretend to be the church. As Chuck would often say, the church is God's plan A and there's not a plan B. We come alongside Christians who are called to live in this cultural moment and try to offer the level of clarity that they need to understand the issues of the day, the confidence in a Christian worldview. I think a lot of Christians struggle culturally because they don't have confidence that there's something bigger than culture. We talk about the difference between the story and the moment. Our cultural moment's huge. There's a lot of things we're messing around with as individuals and as a society that are fundamentally new historically. You know, there's been plenty of cultures that have tolerated homosexual, homoerotic behavior. There's not a lot of cultures, if any, that have actually taken that desire and turned it into an identity. That's a dramatic shift.
Yes.
There is a cultures that have disagreed on the best path to virtue or the best path to national success. We're dealing with completely different and competing visions of what the good life or national success could possibly be. So these are difficult times to be a Christian. And yet at the same time, it's still true that Christ is risen from the dead. And so therefore, despair is a sin. Hope is secure. So we want to help Christians respond to the cultural moment with that sort of clarity and confidence so they can be courageous as they need to be. This is really, as our name suggests, we're named after Chuck Colson. He founded the Colson Center as part of his work in the prisons years ago, basically an attempt to go upstream from the brokenness that he was seeing and experiencing among prisoners and the growth in the prison population, the brokenness in family, and realizing that that was fruit, not the root. The root was upstream and how a generation was learning to think about morality, a church that was increasingly becoming irrelevant to the larger cultural issues of the day. And so he spent the last 20 years of his life kind of going around in various ways, radio program called Breakpoint, a training program called the Centurions Program, and trying to help the church realize that culture matters. Where we're at today at the Colson Centers, we don't have to do that. We don't have to convince anyone that culture matters. The last 5 years has made that more than plain. Yes. What we're dealing with now is a feeling of despair, like it's over. We can't do anything about it. The forces of evil are too big, too great. The definitions are too deep that are changing in our lives. And we want to say, well, you're called to this cultural moment as well. And many Christians have engaged where God has called and placed them at times that were just as bleak, dreary, and dark as ours, because the defining aspect of our engagement is not our cleverness or our ability to even understand or our own courage. It's the resurrected Christ. That is a reality in human history that defines everything. So that's what we do. The Breakpoint radio program has become the Breakpoint Commentary, and in addition to the radio audience is a podcast and email. And so every single day we do a deep dive on a particular story or trend happening in the culture in just 4.5 minutes. And we've seen that become staples around dinner tables of Christian families. And we've seen that become actually a lesson plan each and every day at Christian schools and used in Christian colleges, used in sermons and so on. The Centurions program has become the Colson Fellows program. So this year, over 700 Colson Fellows in 60 different cities across the United States are spending a year going deep into Christian worldview and cultural understanding, which is super exciting because, as we tell our team all the time, we don't win at the Colson Center when we say something clever or something even true. We win when something God uses something that we produce to help somebody live their calling where God's placed them. Yes. And to see that in 60 different cities and, you know, even within 8 churches, it actually, you know, a discipleship program called the Colson Fellows program in 8 different churches. Super exciting. So anyway, and then we also do some other things. You know, we have some reading, frequent reading, some video products that go out helping Christians know what to say when they're in tough conversations, some short courses that are focused in. And of course, we're going to be in Austin very soon for an evening event. And that's part of a new initiative of kind of bringing important Christian worldview teaching to cities in bite-sized ways. And so that's what's going to happen in Austin here in a couple weeks.
Yes, great. Yes, and we're all behind it and helping to make it known in every way we can. So why don't you give us a quick definition? You know, you've got some in the book, and what is culture? What is worldview? And what is a Christian worldview? You know, because that kind of everything's
built on that. 3 sentences or less. Yeah, what could go wrong? Well, I mean, culture is just what humans make of the world. That's one of the things that makes humans distinct. I mean, biblically, we would say it's part of being his image bearer. part of being his image bearer is that we were actually called, if you look closely at Genesis 1 and 2, we were called to continue God's creative work in the world. Just like God filled the emptiness and formed the formlessness, we're called to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. He wanted Adam and Eve to do that across the earth, not just across the garden. There was a desire that he had for his world to be cultivated and developed. You can even see it after the flood, when the descendants of Noah were called to disperse all across the face of the earth. And the real problem at the Tower of Babel story in Genesis 9 is not that God hates tall buildings, but that they didn't. They gathered in one place, and God wanted to scatter them, so he confused their languages. That theme is just all the way throughout, and you kind of see that fulfilled in the new heavens and new earth when, you know, that God restores the earth to its original purpose through the work of Christ. All that to say, humans don't just live in the world, we cultivate it. We don't just, you know, we don't just have to deal with life. We ask questions about why are we here? What's the point? What's the good life? You know, animals eat, we garnish our food, we decorate, we create. You know, we ask big questions about life in the world. And all of that is, you know, and how we answer those questions, both in our words, in our how we structure our lives together, think about legal institutions, educational institutions, public policies, how we then order the physical part of the world, think our houses and neighborhoods and roads, how we imagine, think about our stories that we tell through print or through art, think about the imagination applied and entrepreneurship and business. All of this is humans doing something with the world. So we're not just consumers. You know, we're actually producers. We take the world and make it a different place. I mean, think about a cell phone that started as sand. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable cultivation. So that's what we mean by culture. It's not, in other words, the problem isn't that there is culture, which is sometimes how Christians talk about culture, is that the problem is the culture. But the problem isn't that there's culture. The problem is the direction the culture goes, because God wanted the world to be cultivated for his glory. Think about after the fall, suddenly childbirth, which was a good command that God gave Adam and Eve before the fall, and work, which was a good part of who they were, suddenly childbirth was going to hurt and work was going to be frustrating. So what can happen in our culture work as humans, particularly as fallen humans who don't know God or don't care about God, is that our cultural work can be misdirected to our own glory, or to the glory of things that aren't good, aren't true. You know, this is the Romans 1, worship the creation rather than the creator. And we can do that not just in our words and not just by making idols, but in how we actually apply ourselves to the world around us in our culture-making activities. That's what we mean by culture. Worldview is the lens through which we see the world. And so that's why worldview and culture are so intertwined. You could kind of say that the direction we take culture is dependent on how we see the world, you know. Culture is the flesh of worldviews. It's the application. We often say ideas have consequences. The consequences of our ideas, the consequences of our worldview, our vision of reality is culture. Now, everybody has a worldview. The question isn't, do you have a frame of reference through which you interpret the world? The question is, which one do you have? And that's not an easy question always to answer, because worldviews are like contact lenses. You forget they're in there, right? But you're still looking through them all the time. Yes. And if they are, whatever prescription they are, whatever they are, whatever way that they're made is going to frame what you see. And so to a Buddhist, the whole world looks Buddhist. To a Christian, the world looks Christian. And worldviews are really stubborn things until the world gets too big for our worldview. It gets too complicated. It gets too just challenging. In preparation for 9/11 this year, we spent a lot of time going back and listening to the original commentaries that Chuck Colson did on Breakpoint about 9/11, spanned from about September the 12th to about September the 19th, 2001. And one of the things that stunned me is that while people were grasping in the dark, trying to make sense of what happened, Chuck really provided a narrative of the events of that day through a Christian worldview. I mean, you can kind of think, you know, we've seen kind of a Muslim history version of 9/11, and we've seen a, you know, this year the BBC's doing a Through the Eyes of President Bush. There's that wonderful book, The Only Plane in the Sky, that's just chronology. Chuck walked through a multifaceted look from, you know, 7 or 8 different angles at this same event through the lens of a Christian worldview. And it was so, so helpful. So we aired it on our podcast. That's what a worldview does. It interprets things. And the closer a worldview is to being true, the more in focus it brings what happens in the world. You know, it's like a, it's not just like a pair of sunglasses where it shades reality. It's like a pair of prescription glasses. If I, you know, you put on the wrong prescription, suddenly you're not seeing anything.
Yes.
You know, you think you might think you're seeing clearly. You know, my eyes got so bad as a teenager. I remember, like, in between each year when I go back for my eye appointment, I'd be like, oh, this is what reality is, you know, because it was so, it got so much worse. My prescription just wasn't carrying the weight. And that's what a lot of people realize in our world. I think that's what's behind a lot of the despair, a lot of the disenfranchisement with modern culture, a lot of the anger, a lot of the partisanship. It really, at the end of the day, is the product of worldviews that they've long embraced. And it's just not doing, it's just not carrying the weight that it needs to carry to explain existentially the emotional toll that the modern world takes, or scientifically, the scientific things that we're learning, dealing with fear, dealing with evil, dealing with, you know, sickness, disease in the last year. All of this stuff is the stuff of worldviews. And I think what happens for a lot of Christians, especially a lot of Christian students, is that the worldview that they get from the church is very narrow. It's not big enough for the real world. Jesus is the savior of your soul, and not really the creator of heaven and earth and the restorer of all things. And so that can be a really dizzying sort of thing. So a Christian worldview, I think, you know, in one sense, it's the worldview that a Christian holds. And the question is, even a Christian worldview, is it, you know, close to a biblical worldview? But, you know, the best way to understand a Christian worldview is seeing the world as God created it, seeing the world as it actually is, not just seeing it from a Christian slant. Here's another way to say it. I believe the Christian description of reality that we find in Holy Scripture is not just true for Christians. It's true. It's not just true. It's just, yeah, it's true. It's just the way that it is. It's the best description of the world that we have. It doesn't hit everything. It doesn't explain how atoms can be split, or, you know, specifically how certain animals do certain things. What it does explain, though, is the sort of world that we live in and the sort of creatures that humans are, and the relationship between humans and God, and humans and each other, and humans in the created order. And so it offers a really compelling, clear, accurate description of the world as it is.
Well, one of your speakers at your conferences is Carl Truman. He's a theologian and cultural observer. In a recent interview, he attributes the movement that we're seeing in our culture and the way that people see things to a revolution in selfhood. And he calls it a fundamental transformation in the way that human beings think of their personal identities. You know, in the past, there was kind of a fixed authority or set of circumstances that gave you your identity. Now you choose where you live, you choose what you study, you choose who you marry. That's even different than it was in the Middle Ages. But there's an increasing emphasis also on our inner feelings as fundamental to our identity, rather than what you might call true truth, as you were mentioning, to borrow a phrase from Schaefer. We live in a world where what we feel is giving tremendous authority in who we consider ourselves to be. And Truman takes example of a doctor who 30 years ago would say, well, if I came in and I say, well, I'm a man in a woman's body, the doctor would say, well, your physical body is a man's body and it's a psychological problem. Today you go in, the doctor says, well, you've got a fiscal problem, and we can do something about that. And you've written something similar in the book. You wrote that the culture says we should be who you are and do what you want. Human dignity is grounded in the autonomous will of the individual. Unfettered choice is how humans flourish, so says our culture. So how does this revolution of self-understanding and the emphasis on feelings impact our culture, and how do we respond as Christians?
Yeah, it's only a Christian worldview approach that can make sense of any of this, because a Christian worldview is more than just a Christian view of morality. It's a Christian view of everything, of what's right and wrong, but also what's real, what's true, and what it means to be human. The revolution that has reshaped the modern world is vast, and it started with a revolution in epistemology, you know, the role of revelation, how do we know what we know, and it went to a revolution in ontology, what's real, is there such a thing as the spiritual world, or is the spiritual world itself more just an illusion, or kind of a personal set of personal private preferences. And now it's moved, and the most significant shifts in our culture in the last 30, 40, 50 years has been a shift in anthropology. In other words, if you think that the headline of the last 30, 40 years where so much has changed is a moral headline, where things that were once considered right are now considered wrong, and things that were once considered wrong and is now considered right, that's the story, then you're missing it. Not because there hasn't been a moral revolution, of course there has. But the moral revolution is the fruit, not the root. The root of the shift has been an anthropological shift. In other words, a shift in our understanding of what it means to be human. Now, that started with taking God out of the framing of the universe. Because humans are made in the image of God. The only way to know who you are is not to start by looking at humans, but start by looking at God. In Psalm 135, David writes that, you know, the idols of the nations are deaf and blind and dead, but those who make them will be like them. In other words, there's an intimate connection, both as individuals and as cultures and societies, between what we worship and how we think about ourselves, who we think we are. So now we've reached the point where our emotional state, our self-determination, our inner inclinations and proclivities as individuals are more significant than biological realities, physical realities, the real world as we have often known. And of course, we would never say that about something like gravity, right? Like if I said, I feel like I can fly, because the physical consequences or the physical world is too real, you fall off and you hurt yourself. But we forget that we're still jumping off the cliff by saying things like men can be women and women can be men, because we're basically saying something that's not true, trying to change reality to match our inner whims. It's just that the way down is a lot longer. Yeah. But you still hit the ground. And that's a real challenge. So Christians should engage this issue, because it's the way that people are lost today. They're not just lost in the sense they don't know who God is. They're lost in the sense they don't know who they are. And the damage that comes from living against the grain of the universe like that is huge. Now, so Carl has written the definitive book. Carl Truman, Grove City College professor, has written the definitive book explaining this. It's called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern South. And he's really going to be leading off our event in Austin next week, so that people can really get that framing. The two issues, you might say that's the big cultural undercurrent and the big shift that has taken place. The two waves that has created, the two ways that we've been hit upside the head by this new way of thinking about humans has to do with sex and has to do with race. And so that's why we're going to hit those straight on. Now, you can kind of get a sense in that of kind of our philosophy at the Colson Center, and that is, we don't mind hate mail, I guess, or we don't mind hitting these things head on. And the reason isn't because we want to be provocative, or we want to be mean, or we want to be, grumpy or angry. And you're not going to hear any of that at this event. What you're going to hear is, if Christianity is true, it's big enough for these things. If Christianity is really the right accounting of reality, then we can go straight at the most confusing issues having to do with sexuality and the most dividing and controversial issues having to do with race. And we can make better sense of it. Christianity is better at explaining the world. And I think that this is a central feature of faith, Christian faith in today's culture. And that is, we have got to understand deeply this idea of the image of God. We have to understand how it compares with other visions of what it means to be human. And I'll give you the punchline. You can be confident. Every other vision of what it means to be human is small. It's shriveled. It leaves out complete aspects of reality and life. The image of God is a big, beautiful vision of what it means to be human. And we live in an age, Peter Berger called it an age of perpetual identity crisis. Christians have the best answer on the market. So not only has Christianity been, not only has the image of God been one of the most, let me put it this way. Within a Christian worldview, the image of God is central. Unfortunately, it's kind of become a trivia fact, you know, like most people can answer the question, humans are made in the image of God, but they can't really go deeper than that. Yeah. But the idea of the image of God, this Christian vision of what it means to be human, has been among the most consequential ideas in all of human history. If you want to source back to where we first got the idea as a human civilization that slavery wasn't normal or shouldn't be normal, it comes from the image of God. If you want to dig past how we got to the point where children and women were considered unique, valuable individuals and not just property of men, it goes back to the image of God. If you want to know why, you know, early Christians ran into the woods to pick up these discarded little babies that were thrown out to die by the Romans, it's the image of God. If you want to know why Christians ran into the plague and not away from it, like all the other pagans, it's the image of God. Not only that, but the image of God is a pretty central feature of the biblical story. I mean, you get introduced to the image of God right off the bat. The story culminates in the in Jesus Christ transforming us into his image. It's a restored vision of the image of God so that we could finally be who God created us to be. And suddenly, this is really important to know. And right now, I don't know that there is a more direct place where a Christian worldview directly conflicts and answers the deepest questions of our culture than this question of what it means to be human. So the image of God is almost like if you don't have the image of God in your Christian worldview toolbox, it's like not having a hammer or a screwdriver, you know, around the house. You're going to need it. Right. And not only that, you're not going to be able to do a lot of projects without it. And so anyway, that's why we're locking in not only on these three critical issues of sex, race, and identity, but doing it in this larger framework of the image of God, because we're confident that Christianity is true. And if it's true, you know, by God's grace, then the church can live it out and make a big, big difference in the lives of individuals, but also in our culture at large.
Yeah, our identity as made in the image of God is central to any understanding of the human person from a Christian perspective. One of your speakers, Monique Dewson of the Center for Biblical Unity, says a relationship with Jesus is the only secure option for transforming the hearts of individuals. Changed hearts are the only hope for a changed system. And so we have to start with that beginning point. Even a non-Christian, no matter how vile they may be in their life, they're made in the image of God, and there's a redeeming piece of that person that we can hope for and pray for. Sexuality, you mentioned, sexuality is we're such a oversexed, overpoliticized culture that it might be good just to say, what is the God's vision for good sexuality?
Yeah, well, it's tied to our bodies. I mean, there's so many ways that this goes wrong, right? I mean, 30, 40 years ago when I was growing up and everything was salacious and tempting and sexualized in that way, then it was very much about, did God really say, you know, don't have sex before marriage? And, you know, but what was lost in that whole analysis was why? In other words, before, I love this line from T.S. Eliot. He says, before you know what to do with something, you have to know what something is for. So before you know what to do with a laptop, you got to know what a laptop is for. Before you know what to do with your sexual plumbing, you need to know what that sexual plumbing is for. In other words, purpose precedes morality or, you know, function or anything like that. And we've seen that in our culture where we gave up on the morality and now we're redesigning the purpose itself. So right now, I think the answer is, I'll give you an example. This is one of the brilliant, Jesus was pretty smart, as we can all agree on. In the middle of Matthew 19, a group of legal teachers ask him about divorce. And they specifically ask about the law of Moses as teachers of the law to someone they perceive to be a teacher of the law. Did Moses really say, was the question, and what did he mean? And Jesus answers their question about the law by saying, in effect, don't you know what was true about the beginning? In other words, before we know how to do divorce and marriage, we need to know what marriage is for and whether divorce fits into that purpose. Does that make sense? So he goes beyond the what's right and what's wrong in the doing to go back to what it's for. And from that, he, you know, concludes that, you know, marriage is permanent and so on. You ask the same question. Before we know what is appropriate sexual behavior and what is not, we need to know what sex was for. Now, Genesis 1 and 2 paint this enormous picture that our a sexual capacity fits into the larger context of who we are as human beings, that our sex was primarily God's kind, gracious, good way of allowing us to do what he made us to do. You know, I several years ago, I wrote a book about same-sex marriage when that was happening and trying to figure out how to think and talk about this at a time when it seemed like same-sex marriage was inevitable legally, which obviously it turned out to be.
Sure did, yeah.
And I was writing this and I was traveling somewhere and I was exhausted. And so I kind of tanked out and turned on the TV in the hotel room and caught the movie Gremlins. I don't know if you remember that terrible movie Gremlins. It's from the golden age of cinema, you know, the 80s. And so anyway, it's about these creatures and, you know, this creature starred as this cute, cuddly thing. But, you know, you have to take care of them. And there's three rules. You know, you don't feed them after midnight because then they become these awful gremlin things. And spoiler alert, guess what happens? Yeah. And then you're not supposed to expose it to bright lights because they don't like that. And then, of course, another rule is you're not supposed to get them wet because that's how they multiply. Spoiler alert, not only do they become gremlins, they get wet. And I remember seeing that, thinking to myself, God is kind to us. Now, I know this is going to be the weirdest thing most anyone who's listening to this hears today. But God could have had us fulfill that calling to be fruitful and multiply like gremlins, you know? I mean, it would have changed things. It would have changed the, you know, how seriously we take the weather forecast and, you know, probably would have made us way more creative and yeah. Manufacturing raincoats earlier in human history. I don't know. I mean, there would have had all kinds of, you know, different purposes. But God chose to allow us to fulfill his purpose for us in a weird, pleasurable, awkward, beautiful way in which two people literally become one. And it's interesting when Jesus is asking that question about marriage, he actually uses the phrase one flesh.
Yes.
Now, we often talk about sex today as if it's one emotion. You know, even in our moral teaching to kids, we talk about the importance of emotional bonding of sex, which is certainly true. But Jesus points to the body parts. And you know what? When God says to Adam, it's not good that man is alone, he didn't say, I'll make him someone to keep him company or I'll make him a companion. He said, I'll give him someone who can help him. Now you look at that and you say, well, there was lots of things in the created order that could already help. I mean, God then sent him to name the animals, and animals are super helpful. We've had animals help since the very beginning, pulling our plows, giving us clothes, you know, feeding us. There's all kinds of ways animals can be helpful, but that's not what God said. God said Adam needed suitable help. Another Adam would not have been a suitable helper. Another Eve could not have helped Eve. You know, in order for us not to be alone in fulfilling God's purpose, it requires not just another human, but another human who is who's sexually complementary with us. Another way to say this is you don't need help with any of your body functions. You don't need help respirating or aspirating or digesting. I mean, sometimes you need help with all those things and it's always a bad day. But all those things are created to function in and of themselves. There's one thing you need help with, and that is procreating.
Yeah.
And this is why I think John Paul II looked at the human body as more than just a vehicle for carrying out God's purpose, but as an actual revelation of God's purpose. We look at Scripture. Scripture tells us everything we need to know really about sex. And its purpose, morality, and all that. But you know what else does is nature. The book of nature tells us everything we need to know, you know, because our bodies matter, because when our bodies become one, there's a unitive thing. And when you just, you know, kind of pretend as if you can have sex with however many people you want and there's not any consequences, that ends up breaking you as an individual and breaking a society. In other words, our bodies are special revelation. It's a beautiful, wonderful thought. And again, where does this come from? It comes from a Christian view that our bodies actually matter. So yeah. I know that was a long answer to your question, but that's really because it's the core of our cultural confusion. And it's why we're diving so deep into this, you know, at our sex, race, and identity event.
No, and I appreciate digging in on who we are, our anthropology, our identity as made in the image of God and life in Christ. Appreciate talking about sexuality. Let's touch on the other thing, racial tensions. Racial tensions are a present reality. How should a Christian consider racial conciliation? And I'm using the word conciliation instead of reconciliation because a local pastor, Joseph Parker, said the races really have never been brought together in full understanding and empathy. And you must be together in a meaningful way and have lost that togetherness before you can be reconciled. So How can Christians have racial conciliation from a biblical perspective and engage in an honest, respectful conversation?
Well, you know, again, there's not going to be an answer that comes from any other worldview. If you start in a naturalistic evolutionary framework, then racial competition is part of the created order, part of the natural order and part of the survival of the fittest effort, which is why so many people who champion that evolutionary framework, either in biology or especially in sociology or public policy, government, scientific investigation, they actually took that into this, you know, super racist, eugenic sort of way.
Yeah.
You know, you also have in our dominant postmodern theories about race, which right now are ruling the day on college campuses, and in media, this, you know, what's kind of goes under the badge critical race theory. And I know the critique is as well, you know, the critical race theory is an official, you know, academic area of study. And they said the same thing about postmodernism. And what I said back in the 90s is, yeah, postmodernism comes from some really interesting and technical academic philosophers, all of which were out of France, but I'll let that, you know, reference go. But there's also, you know, Kurt Cobain, Britney Spears, Eminem, and The Matrix. In other words, there's the cultural mood that is quite postmodern, that is reflecting some of these same sorts of ideas about truth and morality and reality and identity. Same thing's happening with CRT, where these ideas are fundamentally entering where you are the most true identity of who you are is your racial affiliation or your racial appearance. That's a wrong starting point for who we are. When our founders wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all are created equal," we had to look at that and say, it's not self-evident on the outside that we're all created equal. If there's a shared humanity that we have, it can't be based on the outside. It's got to be based on something intrinsic that we all share. But CRT moves our deepest definition of who we are from the inside to the outside. It also says that, you know, certain people are fallen in different ways than others based on which racial category they belong to. If they belong to this race, then their sin looks like this. And if they belong to this race, their sin looks like this. And then, of course, it also lands, and many times it, you at least get the impression that restoration or any sort of conciliation or reconciliation, whichever word you want to use, is impossible.
Yeah.
Now, you put that alongside not only this view of the image of God that is a shared humanity, that is something that's endowed and given by God, you know, as part of our deepest identity and who we are. And the body's part of that, but not all of that. And you compare that with our understanding of fallenness and the racial sins that we see from one context to the next, culturally or historically, aren't dependent on skin color. They're dependent on a common universal human condition after Eden. And then you look at this remarkable thing, and this is one of the reasons I love Monique. I'm so glad she's going to be joining us on Saturday the 18th there in Austin at Hill Country. Is that Monique says, you know, if we're followers of Christ, I don't know how all this works out, but we are reconciled to one another. In other words, it is a statement of accomplishment because of what Christ has done, not because of some either cultural hoops or something else. Now, again, as Paul then goes on to talk about, we should work that out in how we treat and love one another, including the least of these. And he would go after Corinth, the Church of Corinth, among others, if they didn't apply it equally to the rich and to the poor and this socioeconomic group and this socioeconomic group or this race or that ethnicity. But I guess the deeper point is that this impossibility of redemption that we hear today between the races is a direct contradiction to a biblical framework in which Christ has accomplished something. Now, what that looks like, how we play that out, we got to fight through that and we got to look at it and apply it. But there is not a hope of a universal human dignity. There is not a hope of properly understanding the human condition, and there's not a hope of moving forward outside of Christ. So again, it's a controversial topic. Monique's got such a great story, by the way. She was raised in South Central LA, single mom, you know, ethnic minority community, impoverished, and had her mind radically changed on these issues from what she used to think and what she used to believe. And it's powerful, because when you reduce someone's identity down to their tribe, and you try to say something that is true, you oftentimes get the response, well, you don't know me. Or, if you knew someone who was attracted to the same sex, or you knew a gay person or a transgender person, then you would think differently. And when you meet someone like Monique, or you met somebody of a different race or whatever, you meet somebody like Monique and it's like, well, wait, this is, she has had all the experiences. And what she's trying to do is judge her experiences by what is true, not reframe what is true by her experiences. And that is a remarkably rare thing today.
Yes.
But it goes to the heart of this fundamental shift in who we think we are that Carl Truman will describe. So that's how all these things fit together. Yeah. And it's going to be an important conversation to have.
Well, appreciate the unity in these things that you're pulling together. So if I would sum it up, then the image of God, being made in his image, being in Christ, that's the uniter, and that's your identity. And if we seek our identity in our sexual, in our gender, in our sexual attraction, or in our racial makeup, our racial tribe, these are things that can take us away. And yet how the challenge then is to understand how we bring that image of God into our conversation and into the way that we love one another and reach out to one another, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, I would add that, you know, our sexuality is certainly a part of our identity because our bodies matter. But yeah, to take our sexual inclinations and, you know, act as if our bodies are irrelevant or we can actually be born in the wrong body, you know, that's wrong. Our racial and ethnic identity is part of our identity. And that kind of goes to where,
sure,
you know, again, back to where we started, Paul saying that God determines the exact times and places in which we live. And to be a part of a particular ethnicity is not bad in and of itself.
Yeah.
But all these God-given good gifts, our body parts, our skin color, all of those things can be used for God's glory as he created them, or they can be torn apart. And one of the great temptations is to take our fallen expressions of who we are, as if they, and then sanctify them as if they are the way God wants them. But, you know, we're fallen. All have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. We remember then that God came not to make us less human, but God came to restore our humanness. He came to make us fully and truly human in the image of his Son, the most truly and fully human creature. The most truly and fully human being that's ever, you know, walked on earth. And that's what we can put in front of us. So there is an identity in Christ, but it's connected to the identity in creation. Mm-hmm. You know, these aspects aren't less than who we are, but we're certainly more than all that. Yeah. And understanding that in the larger context is so important.
Mm-hmm. Somehow it brings to mind the seven blind men trying to describe an elephant. You know, they're all right. All these pieces do fit together, but the
unity. Yeah, but they're still an elephant. Yeah. And, you know, he ain't a snake and he ain't a trunk. Yeah. And, you know, they're still the elephant. And the elephant is still what the elephant is. So,
yeah, we're still made in the image of God.
That's right.
That's the uniqueness. And for those of us who are Christ followers, we have that dimension of trusting and knowing him. Well, John, thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it. And we encourage everyone to visit the Colson Center website, learn about the conferences they're putting on, learn about the regular materials that they're putting out. John's a fount of information, and he's got a team around him, and they just keep putting out good and important information for the body of Christ. So thank you, John, for your good work. We appreciate it.
And you bet. Thanks so much.
To our audience, I want to thank you for being with us today. We appreciate you joining us for our ongoing dialogue with Christian leaders on how we live as followers of Jesus Christ. I'm Larry Linenschmidt, your host for Hill Country Institute Live and Executive Director of the Hill Country Institute. We invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to hear past programs and to experience audio and video from our conferences on faith and culture issues, including art, creation care, human trafficking, and more. You can also listen to this program and past programs on your podcast app at Hill Country Institute Live. Would you prayerfully consider a donation to support this program and the ministry of the Hill Country Institute? You can donate online at hillcountryinstitute.org, or you can call us at 512-680-7993. We appreciate your help in paying the radio station to stay on the air and continue our efforts to serve the body of Christ. Thank you again for being with us. And remember, wherever God calls you, share the heart, mind, and love of Jesus Christ.